Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On September 12, 2001, Michelle Harris went missing from a small town in upstate New York. She has never been found, and the mystery surrounding her disappearance remains. For years after she went missing, her wealthy husband, Cal Harris, was arrested and charged with her murder. With neither a body nor a murder weapon, Cal was shockingly tried and convicted of her murder. Then new evidence surfaced. His conviction was overturned and a new trial granted, but once again, he was convicted and sentenced to 25 years to life in prison. That conviction, too, was overturned on appeal. The saga continued as Cal went on trial for the third time. This one ended in a mistrial. By the time Cal went on trial the fourth time, Michelle had been missing for nearly 15 years. Defense investigator David M. Beers worked on the Cal Harris case from start to finish. His account, Reign of Injustice, walks you through the details and events of the case never before revealed. It provides an inside view of the scandalous case, facts that you will not find elsewhere, including why he considers Cal's story a reign of injustice. The book that we're featuring this evening is Reign of Injustice, The Cal Harris Story, with my special guest, journalist, author, and special investigator, David M. Beers. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, David M. Beers.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to the interview.
Thank you very much. Incredible tale. I had not known of this before. This is an amazing tale, Reign of Injustice. Let's go right as you do in this book here to Owego, New York, and Cal Harris and the two automobile dealerships that he owns. And, of course, it's set in 9/11/2001. So tell us a little bit about Cal Harris, his background, where Owego, New York is specifically. Tell us, give us a little bit of background as you do in this book.
Okay. Owego, New York is in Tioga County, New York, which is in south central New York. Just above the Pennsylvania border, right between the cities of Binghamton to the east and Elmira to the west. Owego is just a little village, and Tioga County itself is a rather small county population-wise, only about 51,000 people. There are no cities, so the county seat is right in the little village of Owego. It's kind of nestled right in along the north side of the Susquehanna River. Just west of the village in the town of Tioga, another small township, Cal Harris and his older brother, Kevin, owned two car dealerships. Cal owned Royal Ford on the south side of the highway. And his brother Kevin owned and operated Royal Chrysler to the north. But Cal also owned another Royal Chevrolet dealership up in Cortland, New York, which is about 45 minutes north of Owego. They've been in business for several years. The Royal Auto Group was started by Cal's father, Dwight Harris. He was a pretty popular entrepreneurial business tycoon in Tioga County, starting many business enterprises before going into the automobile business. And then when his sons, after they were educated in college or whatever, they he groomed them into the automobile dealership business, and later they took over the day-to-day operations. So that kind of sets the stage for what Cal was. Cal was born and raised in a kind of an upper middle class home. Went to high school in Vestal, New York. He's a very handsome young man, very talented athlete. Became a star lacrosse player, and then he went on to college. I believe he played lacrosse in college as well. He studied business and economics. And then, like I said, he was groomed into the family automobile dealership. He was kind of thrust into the position a little prematurely after his father had a heart attack. And he found himself supervising people who were his parents' age. So it was a little awkward for him. So he had to learn the ropes rather quickly. His wife, Michelle, she grew up in a kind of a lower middle class neighborhood just west of Owego in the little town of Tioga. She was like 4 years younger than Cal. She went to Tioga High School. And then after high school, she went to Morrisville College in New York. And then when she finished her education, she went to work for the Royal Auto Group in Owego. And it was there that Cal met Michelle. And they hit it off right away. It was like love at first sight. She was gorgeous, kind of head-turning, attractive, very personable, fun-loving. And they hit it off immediately, started dating, moved in together. And then within about 4 years, they got married. I believe it was 1990.
Right.
And it was kind of a lakeside ceremony at a lake, some lake property that Cal and his father had owned in the town of Spencer, several miles north of Owego. And then after they got married, Cal built Michelle a beautiful lakeside home, half million dollar home on the lake. It was in a really remote area. You couldn't even see their house from the road. Or the road from the house. And it was 250 acres plus of just wilderness area, most of which was all densely wooded. There were a few open fields and a lake, of course, and a pond. But they, they spent a considerable amount of time, entertaining family and friends, snowmobiling, hay rides, swimming, fishing, hunting, riding ATVs, and that was an enjoyable part of their life. And then along the way, they had four children in a relatively short period of time. In fact, at the time that Michelle disappeared, their oldest child, Taylor, was only seven, and the youngest of four, Tanner, was only 18 months old. So you can see how closely they were in age at the time. So that kind of lays the groundwork for a little bit of history on Cal and Michelle and how they met and started living together and then got married. And I guess I should also add that, trouble started brewing in the marriage at some point in time. And it only got worse when Michelle discovered that Cal was having an affair. But unbeknownst to Cal, Michelle was having an affair as well. And she had started seeing and dating a man and for like 6 months, and unbeknownst to Cal at the time. And she started going on weekend rendezvous with him in the Poconos. They were using PIN number calling cards to call each other to keep their relationship secret. And then at some point, this boyfriend, he fell head over heels for Michelle, and he packed his bags. He was from Philadelphia. He packed his bags, left his girlfriend, his family, his job, and moved up to New York and found an apartment and a job to be near Michelle with with expectations of getting married, even though that wasn't, he didn't have this, Michelle did not have the same expectations. So anyway, that kind of sets the stage and a little background.
What was the living arrangement, and what was the, in terms of the divorce that they, you know, that was imminent, what was where was the state of proceedings at that point? Tell us the living conditions and where they were at. He knew about, she had a job as well at this waitress, new job at this, as a waitress at this place called Lefty's, and also talk about the breast implants that she had recently gotten as well.
I'm trying to think. I think it was January of 2001 that Michelle filed for divorce. Cal did not take it well. There were a lot of heated arguments, which got rather nasty at times, according to, you know, some witnesses who overheard those arguments. But none of the witnesses had ever noticed anything physical. It was all, you know, verbal altercations. In fact, one of their adult babysitters, you know, described some of the arguments and said that, you know, Michelle could hold her own, and she could be as verbally abusive to Cal as he was to her. And other people, you know, said similar things. But at some point in time, actually, I think it was early March or April 2001, Michelle decided to take a job as a waitress at a somewhat lower class bar restaurant down in Waverly, New York, which is probably a 20-minute drive for her to get to work. And she was telling family and friends that the reason she took the job was because Cal had cut her off financially, which turned out to be not true. You know, the records later indicated that Cal was paying her like $400 a week. Plus he was still giving her a dealership car to use, free gas, anytime she needed it at the dealership.
Right.
And we later learned that, the real reason she took the job wasn't because she needed the money. It was because she didn't want to go home, or she didn't want to be home and argue with Cal. So she wanted to distance herself from him, plus have more time to socialize with her new boyfriend. And then somewhere along the line, I'm not sure the exact time frame, but after she'd already had four children, she went out and had a breast implant augmentation job done. And according to some witnesses I talked to, you know, she went from an A cup to a C cup, and then they used to make fun of her a little bit in conversation. But for probably the most bizarre thing about that was that after she did that, it became kind of the talk of the town, and she was actually flaunting it. And at times she would flash her breasts in front of other men, even in public, at the dealerships or in a bar. And in fact, one witness I talked to had actually seen her do it in front of a guy at a bar down in Waverly after she got out of work and went to this bar. She flashed her chest, and he remembered scolding her for that, telling her that she was just encouraging these creeps. But that didn't stop her. And in fact, it went as far as, you know, some of these men that she had flashed her breast to had also asked her if they could feel what they were like, because they never felt implants before, and she let them do it. I just thought that was pretty bizarre. But Michelle was just very trusting, and I think she saw all of this as just a fun-loving way of getting attention, and I don't think she realized that she was making herself vulnerable to what these guys might have had in mind.
Now, tell us who Barb Thayer is, and her role in the story and so far, not to give anything away, but
Barb Thayer was Cal and Michelle's adult babysitter. Barb Thayer was probably in her early mid 50s, a sweet little lady, gray hair. I met her and interviewed her early in the investigation. And that's when I learned about the arguments that she'd overheard and how they got nasty and vulgar at times. And she'd worked for Cal and Michelle for several years, babysitting and doing house cleaning, laundry, that type of thing. And it was Barb Thayer who first discovered Michelle's van at the end of the Harris driveway on the morning that she was reported missing. Backing up just a little bit, the night before, Cal had come home from work around 6:30 from his office in Cortland. He usually works in Cortland on Tuesdays. And he'd called Barb ahead of time around 5:30, said, I'm wrapping up here. I'll be home in about an hour. And he was. And so as soon as he got home, she left. And Cal, you know, played with the kids for a while, but it was a school night. So we put him to bed about 8 o'clock. And then he worked in his office for a while and then went to bed himself around 10, 10:30. And then when he got up in the morning, he showered and got dressed for work, and he went downstairs, assuming that Michelle would be there, you know, getting the kids up and ready for school. Because prior to that, you had mentioned what the living arrangements were. They were still living in the same marital home while the divorce was pending, but Michelle was sleeping in the family room downstairs, and Cal was sleeping in the bedroom upstairs. So during that period of time, you know, when Michelle came home from work, she would sleep in the family room, but then she would get up and take care of her mother responsibilities regarding the children, getting them ready for school. But when Cal went down the stairs that morning, on the morning of the 12th, she wasn't there. And he peeked out in the garage, and her van was not there. So at that time, he knew she had a boyfriend, and he just assumed that she was still with him and running late. But because he wanted to stay on schedule and get to work on time and get the kids to school on time, he needed some help. So he called Barb Thayer. She wasn't scheduled to come over till later. But anyway, he called Barb Thayer like at 7 in the morning and explained that Michelle hadn't come home. So Thayer agreed to come over and give him a hand. So a few minutes later, she leaves her house, comes over. And when she arrives at the end of the Harris driveway, which like I mentioned earlier, you can't see from the house because the driveway is like a quarter mile long. Anyway, she spots Michelle's van parked right in the nose of the driveway. So she stops, gets out, looks through Michelle's van. The door was unlocked. The key was in the ignition. So she opens up the driver's door, looks around, and then she goes in the back, lifts up the tailgate, looking around. No sign of Michelle. So she gets back in the car and drives into the house, walks in and sees Cal. He's dressed, ready for work. And she said, you know, is Michelle... Or Cal, she says, is Michelle home? And Cal says, no, I told you, she didn't come home. He says, well, I just saw her van out the end of the driveway. So they both start speculating as to what might have happened. You know, did she stop there and park the car and go out with somebody else? Or did she just wander off? They really didn't know. So anyway, finally Cal says, well, we better go get it. We better go get her van. So he drives Barb Thayer out to the end of the driveway. They both look through the van again, and then Barb Thayer drives Michelle's van back into the house and parks it in the garage where she normally would. And then they're looking through the van to look for the kids' book bags and that type of thing to get them ready for school. And, you know, Cal makes the comment of how messy the van looked. And he said that, you know, we better get this down to the dealership where I can get it serviced, which is overdue, and clean it out. It's a mess. At the time, Barb Thayer thought that was a little unusual under the circumstances. But they didn't do that. They didn't do that. Cal took the three oldest kids in his truck and took them to Owego and got them to school. And then he went to work at the dealership. They're only a couple minutes apart. And Barb Thayer stayed where the youngest went at home. And then, so in the meantime, Barb Thayer gets a telephone call from Michelle's best friend, Nikki Burdick, looking for Michelle. Well, Barb Thayer explains the whole story. And Nikki said, well, she's supposed to have an appointment with her attorney today. I better call him. So she did. And then the attorney calls the state police. And sets up a conference call between himself and Nikki Burdick and the state police, and they explain the situation. And the attorney requested that they start a missing person case, which they did. They launched it within an hour, which is in itself is pretty unusual. You know, most people are told, you know, you got to wait 24 hours. Well, they didn't wait 24 hours. They felt something was wrong, and they started their investigation right away. So less than an hour later, you know, two state police investigators are walking into Cal's office at his dealership to ask him some questions about Michelle and what he could tell him. And he cooperated with them fully, talked to them for a length of time, and then he escorted them out to his house, showed them where Michelle's van was parked, and then it took them into the house, and they looked through the van. And then they, Cal said, you know, I need to get back to work. And he left them there to do their thing, and which they did. And they towed Michelle's van back into the state police barracks so they could take a closer look. And then they went back and interviewed Cal some more. So that kind of gives you a rough synopsis of what took place and how it was determined that Michelle was missing.
Now, you talk about Stan Drazen, the divorce lawyer, and so he reached out to state police, you said. Now, who did he speak to?
No, not Stan Drazen. Stan Drazen was Cal's attorney.
Okay, pardon me.
Michelle's attorney was Robert Miller.
Right, pardon me, yes.
So so we can clarify that. Yeah, Robert Miller had an office down in Waverly, and she had retained him to work on the divorce. So he was the one that was called when it was discovered that Michelle was missing, and he was the one that called the state police.
Now, how did state police proceed with her disappearance?
Like I said, they proceeded rather quickly. Less than an hour, the investigators were at Cal's office and then up to his house. And then he left them up there to do whatever they felt they needed to do. He actually gave them a written consent to search his house and his surrounding property, his truck, Michelle's van, whatever they needed. He even turned over phone records, business records, home computer. There was a call on the answering machine that he saved for them, thinking it might be helpful, and so he was very cooperative. But after he went back to work that day, they stayed there. The state police stayed there and were looking through the house and around the property, and then they started calling in for help to do a more thorough search. They called the New York State Forest Rangers, they called for the helicopter, they called for divers, they called for cadaver dogs. So there was a whole contingent of search efforts put in place to try to find Michelle. But it didn't all happen that first day. They were actually there from, I'm going to say, late morning until dinner time, looking for Michelle, maybe 6 hours. And they didn't find anything at all. So they packed up and left. And then Cal found out that they were done. So he picked up the kids, and he'd originally taken them to dinner, but then he took them home, and the state police were gone. So he remained at home that evening, and a couple family members showed up to offer their support. And but the next day, the police were back, and they started putting together this massive search detail, bringing in all those entities that I just mentioned. And then they spent the next it eventually led to them getting a search warrant. Originally, they were working under the written consent that Cal had given them.
Right.
But then one of the forensic investigators, where actually there was a team of two, they went in to take a little closer look inside the house, and while they were there, they found some specks of blood, tiny specks of blood, on the garage, initially on the wall in the garage, and on the entryway to the kitchen from the garage. So they halted their assessment and applied for a search warrant, which is exactly what should have been done. So everybody cleared out, and they posted sentries at the door to preserve the scene. And the next day, they were back with a full contingent looking for further evidence. And it was then when they found, in the next couple of days, they found some additional blood on the garage floor, but it was still very, very tiny, a centimeter or less at most. So, you know, about an eighth of an inch, really tiny. But the interesting thing was they took some random samples and field tested them, and they came back positive for blood, even though a field test is only positive for blood, period. It's not, it could be, it doesn't, it's not species specific. So it could be animal blood, right, or human blood. So you won't know further until you test it further. But anyway, those early presumptive tests, they never photographed the areas that were tested. They never documented it, which was very unfortunate. And it was kind of a violation of crime scene protocol, but the interesting thing was they waited. It was like 4 days after Michelle went missing before they started to photograph the blood.
Wow.
which was very detrimental, because the whole issue that came up later was was not only the volume of blood was small, but the age of the blood. That became crucial because there wasn't a sufficient volume there to suggest that somebody had been seriously injured or killed, so now the age of the blood becomes important, and they were not really able to do that, to age the blood, because it was dry, it wasn't fresh, so there was no way to determine how old the blood was. So an innocent explanation easily presented itself, but they kind of ignored that and proceeded as if that was evidence of a crime.
Now, at the same time, you write that he is not charged despite their suspicions or their beliefs, and he hires, as you mentioned, Stan Drazen is his attorney. And
yeah.
Cal also got a Joseph P. Cowley, Jr.,
Yes.
Now, tell me about Joseph P. Cowley and your relationship to him, and how you got involved in this case.
Okay. Prior to this case, I had an ongoing working relationship with attorney Joe Cowley for several years. I'd been doing defense work for him for several years. He was very good at what he did. He was a very highly respected defense attorney in neighboring Broome County, New York. And when the police started questioning Cal more and more and more, you know, he was keeping his business attorney advised of what was going on. And then it reached a point where they finally asked him to take a polygraph exam. And initially he responded right away, yeah, I'd be glad to. But he said my attorney, you know, wanted me to let him know if there were any legal issues came up. So he called his attorney, Stan Drazen at the time, and Stan said, no, I don't want you, you know, Cal's been cooperative with you for 3 days. I don't want you to question him anymore, and there will be no polygraph. So that was the end of it. But because of that, Stan Drazen knew that they were zeroing in on Cal. So he recommended that he consult with a criminal defense attorney, which and Drazen was not. So he was the one that recommended Joe Colley. So Cal and his dad went to consult with Joe Colley, and Joe called me right away. He says, you know, I'd like you to be involved in this. So I went in and met with him, with Joe and Cal and his dad, and then I was retained on the spot, and which was unusual because ordinarily I don't get involved in a case unless the defendant has already been charged. But in this case, it was still just a missing person case. But because of the suspicion that Cal was involved, they wanted to get a jump on the investigation to find out what we could learn. So that's how I got involved and started to work on the case, even though I wasn't privy to anything the police were doing, because he hadn't been charged with anything. So therefore, there was no discovery material to give me some guidance as to what had already been done. So for the most part, I was working blind.
Now you say working blind, but however, tell us about your prior background with the state police and also what some of those prior relationships meant in terms of you had friends that were involved in this, so at least you understood. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, my training and experience came from the New York State Police. I worked as a uniformed trooper. Became pretty good at that. I later became a police instructor. I helped to put together a highway drug and addiction program, and then I helped to teach it statewide. And then later I was promoted to investigator, and I worked in the narcotics unit for about 4 years. And then I was transferred into the forensic identification unit doing crime scene investigation. So I received additional training there. Later I worked in the violent felony warrant squad. And so I had a lot of experience. So I knew how the police operated. I knew how they did things. I knew how they conduct major case investigations with lead desks. And so I had a pretty good working knowledge of what they were doing and why they were doing it. But I just wasn't privy in this case as to what the results were, because they were under no obligation at that stage to turn over anything that they had learned. But I knew what they were doing. I just didn't know what they were finding and what the results were. So I had to rely on what Cal could tell me, maybe a snippet or two from the newspaper. But then I had to start pretty much from scratch. And, you know, one of the first things I did was visit the so-called crime scene, which I did. You know, Cal was very cooperative, you know, and he spent as much time with me as I wanted. And then, you know, he introduced me to Barb Thayer, and I talked with her. And then I went and talked to family and friends and coworkers, just trying to get a heads up on what the state police might be doing. So that's kind of it. Is there something more that you want me to include, or?
Well, you mentioned about Stan Drazen, and I don't know the chronological order, but when does Drazen have a conversation with Susan Mulvey and tell our audience who she is and a little bit about her background, as you found?
Yeah, okay. The lead investigator, we learned very early on who the lead investigator was. It was a senior investigator by the name of Susan Mulvey. I knew who she was. I'd never worked with her personally, but you know, we knew each other from being on the job together. She came on the state police about a year after I did. I came on and I graduated from the State Police Academy in 1978. And I think she came in the class right after that in 79. So I knew she was working on the Cal Harris case. I found out from Stan Drazen when we met in Joe Cawley's office, and he described, you know, Sue Mulvey coming into his office, I'm going to say about 2 days after Michelle was reported missing, and it looked him right in the eye and said, you know, I know Cal killed her, and I'm going to prove it.
Wow.
And at that stage, I believe at that stage, they hadn't even found the blood yet. So it became pretty obvious to me what their focus was, and that Cal was in their crosshairs. He was their number one suspect, and it was very premature to say that, but that's what she said according to Drazen. So as you mentioned in your lead in that you know, Michelle went missing in 2001. But Cal wasn't indicted until 4 years later, in 2005. But in the interim, they didn't find anything new. I mean, they had those few specks of blood in the garage and in the entryway that some of which matched the DNA profile of Michelle. But like I said, the volume of the blood was tiny. And the age of the blood was inconclusive. But despite that, you know, 4 years later, not having found Michelle or a murder weapon or anything further, they decided to go ahead and indict him, which they did. So once he was indicted and arrested and arraigned, a few weeks later, we started getting discovery material from the district attorney, Gerald King. So that was our first glimpse at what the state police were doing, who they were interviewing, and what the people were saying. While we were waiting for the discovery material to come in, you know, Cal had been released on bail, so he was free for us to meet with him and, you know, prepare our defense. So during one of my meetings with Cal, he was asking me, you know, he knew my background was with the state police, so he was asking me if I knew any of the investigators working the case, specifically Sue Mulvey. So I started telling him what I knew about her. You know, she had come from a police family. Her father had once been the sheriff of neighboring Broome County, New York, back in the mid to late 70s. But he lost his bid for sheriff. That's what prompted Cal. When he found out that Sue Mulvey's maiden name was Andrews and that she was the daughter of John Andrews, he kind of went berserk. I still remember him standing up. He got red-faced and fire in his eyes. He said, John Andrews is Mulvey's father? He was livid. And so I knew I'd kind of hit a nerve there. So I said, I'm assuming you knew he was the sheriff of Broome County. Yeah, I knew that. But they didn't know that Mulvey was his daughter. You know, this is crazy. You know, he said so. You know, he got right on the phone to Joe Cawley, and Joe wasn't available at the time, so we talked some more. And I filled him in on what I knew about Mulvey and her dad, and that just made him more angry that he couldn't understand why she could be involved in this case. So eventually, we spoke to Joe Cawley about it, and but like I said, we were already 4 years into this. He'd already been indicted, arrested, so any conflict that there was, bringing it to the attention of the district attorney or state police administration, we felt that it would just fall on deaf ears because the bell had already been rung. So we decided not to make an issue of that at the time, but we wanted to closely monitor, you know, her involvement and go back and look at it even right from the beginning and up to the current status of the investigation. And then eventually there came a time when I was so disturbed at some of the things I was finding regarding Sue Mulvey that I decided to take a closer look at her. And in that regard, I reached out to a couple of my trusted colleagues who had since retired from the state police, and they reminded me of a case she had worked on back in 96 that resulted in her being kind of admonished by the Court of Claims in a lawsuit that was filed against her for coercing the confession out of a juvenile. And she was admonished rather severely. We didn't know any of that until I started doing the research. And I actually got a copy of the Court of Claims, the original complaint and the decision. And I wrote that in the book, the results of that. And so that was very disturbing, that, you know, what she did to that young man. For whatever reason, she was never disciplined by the state police. In fact, it was just the opposite. They actually promoted her and gave her a new position as a senior investigator down in Owego. And then a short time later, the Cal Harris case came along.
You also write about, very interestingly, Dr. Henry Lee and his role in this. Tell us, with this, who they chose, and this person's of O.J. Simpson fame, but tell us why he was hired and what he was maintaining on behalf of the prosecution regarding the blood.
Yeah, well Dr. Henry Lee is kind of a nationally renowned expert on in forensic blood interpretation and analysis. So they consulted with him several times. They took some their photographs and their physical evidence and to his lab up in Connecticut and had him look at it in hopes of him being able to say that this was a crime scene or that this was evidence of an assault. And if he could say anything about the age of the blood or the volume of the blood. And Dr. Lee never did a report. So we were kind of at a loss as to what he was going to say when he testified. But when he finally did testify, actually before the first trial, his testimony was kind of taken out of order because he had a scheduling conflict, so they had to videotape his testimony early, and then present that to the court later. But during that testimony, you know, probably the most critical thing that he said was that, in his opinion, based on his experience, he felt that the age of the blood was within a couple of days. And we, you know, we argued very aggressively that there was really no scientific way to determine that, and there's not. but he stuck with that testimony. Later on, the court ruled against him and said he couldn't do that. So any subsequent testimony, he would not be able to say with any reasonable degree of scientific certainty that it was a couple of days. So he was prevented from testifying about that in the future trials. But probably one of the more troubling things with Dr. Lee was that we discovered later was, you know, we found out that about a year and a half before the trial, the first trial, Dr. Lee held a strategy meeting in his lab up in Connecticut, which was attended by senior members of the state police and a district attorney, of course, Dr. Lee himself. And what we didn't know until much later was that a national news magazine had come in and videotaped that meeting, which we thought was pretty bizarre. You know how they even knew about it is hard to imagine. Somebody had to have called them, and why they were allowed to come in during a pretrial strategy meeting is really unbelievable. But anyway, they did it, and they went in and they videotaped this discussion. And of course, after Cal was convicted the first time, segments of that video were presented on 48 Hours. But when the defense team reviewed that footage on the broadcast version, it was later determined that a lot of it had been obviously edited out. And Cal's new attorney at that time, Bruce Barquette, who came into the picture before the third trial, he wanted to get all of the raw footage. So he made application for it. It was originally denied. He appealed it, and eventually the CBS had to turn it over. And when we looked at the footage, the most troubling part was when District Attorney Gerald Keene and is talking with Dr. Lee, and he says that the photographs that the state police took of the blood had been altered. And then Mulvey is heard trying to clarify it by saying, oh, they were just corrected, which, wow. You know, either of which would be inappropriate.
Sure.
And so that was really, really troubling. And you could hear that on a couple of occasions during that video segment. And then Keene is actually, I believe, asking Dr. Lee if the blood could have come from a cut hand. And Dr. Lee said, yeah, it could come from a cut hand. But Keene never tells him that he had information in the divorce papers that showed that that was claiming that Michelle had cut her hand in an incident with Cal back in March of 2001, and it happened to be right out in the driveway. But at least during that video segment, you know, Keene never told Lee about that. It was kind of troubling for us that they were pursuing trying to get Dr. Lee to testify that the blood was much more recent than it appeared. And one of the other things that was pretty significant was that, you know, we had our own blood, our own photograph expert look at the photographs that they did have. And he told us that they had actually augmented the red tone by turning up the red color by some 20 points, whatever that means, so that it would appear redder than it actually was. and therefore making it look more recent than it was. So, and then the troubling part too was that, you know, Dr. Lee knew that the photographs had been altered, but yet he still uses them in his assessment before offering his testimony.
Incredible. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, Third Love. My wife, Lisa, is a former bra fitter, and she always remarked that she had problems finding bras that fit properly. So she was excited to receive her 24/7 black lace contour plunge bra. She loved how it looked, I agreed, and she commented how comfortable the Third Love bra felt wearing it all day. She loves her Third Love bra. Designed for your perfect fit, Third Love uses the measurements of millions of women to design bras with all-day comfort and support. Our perfect fit promise, 60 days to wash it and wear it. If you don't love it, returns are always free. Bras in over 80 sizes, cups AA1, including half cups and bands 30 to 48, all made with signature memory foam, flip straps, and smooth band, scratch-free band with a printed label. Find your fit in 60 seconds. Over 15 million women have taken their online Fit Finder quiz to find their perfect fit. Just answer a few simple questions to find your perfect fit in 60 seconds. Did you know breast shape matters when finding a good fit? Third Love helps you identify your bra size and shape and find styles that fit your body. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now, they're offering my listeners 15% off their first order. Go to thirdlove.com/truemurder now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/truemurder for 15% off today. Now, David, the investigation into this on behalf of Cal Harris, you go through in this book in incredible detail this journey we follow along with you to go through and first start with what you say and claim is the police would have been normal procedure to follow up completely on every possible suspect besides Cal Harris. So you went to talk to people like Brian Early. Tell us about this journey, about this investigation, and how you eventually get to the point where you think you have some very, very viable suspects rather than Cal Harris.
Yeah, it's of course, that evolved over a long period of time. And before the first trial, the defense focus, at least for me, was on Brian Early. Because he was the last person to see Michelle alive, at least reportedly at the time. He had an intimate relationship with her. He had, moved up all of his belongings from Philadelphia to New York in anticipation of a relationship with Michelle. He had loaned her $5,000 to help her make a down payment on a home that he at some point in time expected to be living in with her. So as part of the elimination process, it was my opinion that they really took shortcuts and abbreviated what they really should have been done. Probably most importantly, when they found out that from Brian Early that Michelle was at his house that night after work, and then it was only his word that she left his house when he said she did, but yet they never did any forensic work of Brian Early's apartment, his car, his person, or the hunting property that him and his cousins hunted on just over the Pennsylvania border from New York. They went out there and kind of did a look around, but they never even took any photographs. And Brian Early told them that he'd had her out there. So they really dropped the ball, as far as I'm concerned, and by not doing that. Because Michelle had personal belongings at Brian Early's apartment. She had stayed there overnight on occasion. So that was really not the best way to try to eliminate someone. And then she also had a short, intimate relationship with one of the cooks at Lefty's. His name was Michael Casper. They'd had probably a 2-week fling where they had sex 2 or 3 times at his apartment. And Michael Casper had no alibi for that night after Michelle left. And again, they didn't do any forensic work at his apartment or his vehicle or his person. So those things to me were a bit troubling. That if you're looking at these people as true suspects, then you have to eliminate them properly. And I think they spent way too much, way too much credit to the polygraph as a means of eliminating them. And I'm no big fan of the polygraph for a number of reasons, but I was really kind of troubled by the abbreviated methods they used to eliminate suspects. Then there was even back in 2001, there was another suspect by the name of Stacy Stewart, right, who was a patron of Lefty's, who used to come in, always ask for a table in Michelle's section. And initially, at least, he was looked at as a possible suspect. It's not clear why they were looking at him as a suspect, because the information that was released in the discovery didn't include any of that information. But for some reason, just like Brian Early and Michael Casper, Stacy Stewart was asked to take a polygraph. We don't know why. You don't just randomly ask people to take a polygraph unless there's some, you have a reason to believe that they're lying or they've had some type of relationship with the victim.
Right.
And, when I'm looking through all of the leads, I'm looking for, information about Stacy Stewart's polygraph, and it's not there. There was no lead taken regarding his polygraph, even though the preliminary lead indicated that he was scheduled to come in and take one. And as it turned out, they never turned that over. That became an issue much later. Eventually we got a partial copy of his polygraph, but even then it was incomplete compared to the polygraphs that were taken by other suspects, in particular the conclusion page. I thought that was pretty bizarre. But I have to admit, initially I wasn't looking at Stacy Stewart as a viable suspect, because there just wasn't enough information in the lead to suggest that. But it wasn't until after the first trial, a new witness came forward within hours after the Cal's first trial conviction. And this new witness revealed new information that was dynamite, which basically changed the whole dynamics of the investigation and including a new cast of characters, including Stacy Stewart. The new witness was Kevin Tubbs. He was a hay farmer. And he called in right after the conviction to Joe Cawley's office and told him he had some information that he felt was important enough to pass along. And he didn't realize the significance of his information until he'd read an article in the newspaper about the trial. He had misunderstood when Michelle had actually gone missing. And as it turns out, he believed he had seen her at the foot of the driveway on the morning of September 12, 2001, arguing with another man, not her husband. And he described this man and the vehicle he was driving. And it was in the early morning hours, to just probably between 5:45 and 6 a.m. So it wasn't total daylight yet. It was just starting. But he was pulling a hay wagon up the road that goes right by the Harris driveway. Now, it's called Hagedorn Hill. At the time, it was just a dirt road, drainage ditch on both sides. And he's pulling a 9-foot-wide hay wagon. And so he was concerned about whether he'd be able to get by, because this pickup truck was backed out, angled out into the road from the nose of the Harris driveway. And it was partially blocking the road. So he had to swing way over to his left, hoping that he could squeeze by without going in the ditch and losing his load. So as a result, he was just creeping by. And as he was going by, he looks over and he sees a woman who he thinks is Michelle Harris, and this other young man with dark hair, and Michelle appeared to have been crying, or at least upset. And he remembered glaring right at, you know, making eye contact with the young man. So he was able to describe him quite well as his vehicle. But Michelle hadn't signaled that she was in any kind of danger or trouble, so he just continued on his way. And then we learned much later that there was actually a second man who came by and described almost the identical thing. His name was John Steele. He was driving up Hagedorn Hill Road around the same time with a companion. And he described almost the same thing. It was a young man arguing with an older, a woman who was older than he was, with blonde hair and a dark colored truck. But in his case, as he was driving slowly by, you know, he had the passenger window of his truck was down, and he heard the young man say, "Just get in the car. Just get in the damn car," you know, in an argumentative type voice. But like with Kevin Tubbs, you know, he didn't see the woman making any signals that she needed help. So he continued on his way. So neither one of them stopped. Unfortunately, you know, Kevin Tubbs told me later. He says, I wish he'd said something, because I would have gotten out and beaten the snot out of him. And he would have. Kevin was a big guy. And maybe we wouldn't have this conversation if he'd done that. But anyway, it was so based on Kevin Tubbs' revelation, kind of changed everything for the defense. And it was fortunate that he came to the defense first. So for the next 4 months after his disclosure, I started investigating not only Kevin Tubbs, but also what he had seen. And it took me back to the lead regarding Stacy Stewart. And I'm looking through the lead, and I find out they had done some background on Stacy Stewart, including a criminal history and a motor vehicle report. And so he fit the physical description described by Kevin Tubbs, and he drove a truck that matched the description. So I you know, that sent up a red flag for me. So I wanted to learn more about Stacy Stewart. So I started looking a little closer at him. And I actually got one of my colleagues involved to help me. His name was Frank Roney. He lived in Tioga County, so he was more familiar with the area than I was. So he agreed to come on board and help me gather more information on Stacy Stewart and his associates. So he did that, and it just kind of snowballed from there. Everything I learned about Stacy Stewart was pointing to him as that he had some type of involvement with Michelle Harris. And ultimately, it led to Frank and I going to Texas and speaking with witnesses. The first time we went to Texas, we couldn't find Stacy. He knew we were in town, but his cousin that we talked to, wouldn't tell us where he was or how to get a hold of him. But we ended up going back about a year and a half later after we developed more information, and this time we did find him. He was working as a corrections officer for the Department of the Texas Department of Corrections.
Amazing.
And, he was living right on the campus at the Ferguson Prison Unit in Texas, and we found him home. He'd divorced his first wife. He was married to a second wife, and we had about a half hour conversation with him there in his house, and we didn't like the way it went. He was obviously lying to us, and we could tell by the look in his eye he didn't want us there. It's hard to describe the look in his eye, but we knew that he was just making stuff up as we went along. And while we were there, we actually talked to one of his cohorts that had been up to New York with him. His name is Chris Thomason. And the two of them were best buds, at least they were.
Yeah.
But when we started questioning both of them, they started pointing a finger at each other, claiming that the other one was having a relationship with Michelle Harris, and that so that just raised our suspicions even further.
Well, it's interesting how, I got to say, you seem to play these people against each other somewhat, in believing that Stacy Stewart was more so the perpetrator. Not saying that he may have did this alone, but in terms of getting information from Chris Thomason, you get corroboration that the story that he originally told, that he, on that day that he went to work early, that these guys never went to work early. The other interesting and fascinating part and vivid part of this book is when you find out about the property that he owned and then the cement pad. Tell us about this and that search, where, as a reader, we think we might be privy to something very, very amazing going on with the cement pad. Tell us about this.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting how it all developed. As I started taking a closer look at Stacy, one of the things I wanted to do was to learn more about this house that he bought up in the woods. It's just a little log cabin. It sat on about 4 acres of property in a wilderness area with a little pond out front. When I started checking the records, the real property records, I discovered that he had purchased the property only about 3 weeks before Michelle disappeared, and he never made the first payment on his property. It was a very affordable mortgage agreement that he signed with Citibank. Like $400, and he was making real good money there at where he was working at the steel plant. But he never made the first payment, which happened to be due on September 15th, so about 3 days after Michelle went missing. And he never made any other payments. So he started getting the bank started to send notices to him. Foreclosure notices, it turned out that they did foreclose on the property, and then I believe February of 2002. But just prior to that becoming official, he had him and Chris Thomason had packed up and moved back to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty interesting. How all of these things started to happen. When we reached out to some of Stacy and Chris's co-workers at the Nucor steel plant where they worked there as welders on assembly lines, manufacturing steel trusses for commercial, industrial buildings. They were both very good welders, but it was line work. And at the time, they were working 12-hour shifts, 6 in the morning till 6 at night. And one of the things that jumped out at me with Stacy Stewart was that when he was first interviewed by the police, he told them that on the morning of September 12th, he'd gone into work between 4 and 5 a.m. Well, you know, we got his time cards and looked at them, and there were no entries on his time cards at 4 or 5 a.m. And everybody we talked to, including his former supervisor and other coworkers and the safety director, none of them corroborated that anyone would ever go in that early. They said it was line work, assembly line work. You couldn't do anything until everybody was there. There'd be nothing to do if you went in that early. So that became a real suspicious thing for us. But at the time, of course, we didn't discover this until Kevin Tubbs came forward, you know, 6 years into this.
Right.
But at the time, back in 2001, when the police first interviewed Stacy Stewart, that 4 to 5 a.m. time frame wouldn't have been significant to them because they mm-hmm. believed Michelle had been killed around midnight at home by her husband. but when you look at the revelations of Kevin Tubbs, and he sees Michelle with a young man with short dark hair around 6 o'clock in the morning, that kind of changes the whole theory as to when Michelle was killed or abducted. And it just happened to be around 6 o'clock in the morning when Stacy was supposed to be at work. It was our belief that the reason he told the police that he had gone to work between 4 and 5 was to establish an alibi for himself.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have to summarize what happens, and we did in the introduction, what happens in the first trial. He's convicted, he's out on bail. The second trial, the third trial, you have different personnel in the third trial. He's a different defense attorney. Tell us about just summarize what happens in these trials till we get to the fourth trial.
Yeah, after Cal was, after he won his appeal, the second trial, he got released from prison in 2000, and I believe it was October of 2012. And he hired a new attorney by the name of Bruce Barquette. He had a large law firm down in Garden City, New York, Long Island. And, of course, he had his own team of attorneys and other investigators down there. So they became involved, and we had a much bigger defense team now. But I stayed on as the lead investigator and consultant because of my involvement from the beginning. And, Bruce took on a very aggressive approach. And when the case finally went to trial, the third trial, it was finally held in a new venue up in Schoharie County, New York, which was probably 125 miles away from Owego. So we felt we could get a much fairer trial there. But as it turned out, the trial dragged on for like almost 12 weeks. And then when the jury deliberated, they deliberated for like 11 days and couldn't reach a verdict. Even after they were sent back in a couple of times to try, they couldn't. They were virtually split down the middle. So it resulted in a mistrial. But one of the things that Bruce had asked for and was denied during the third trial was the opportunity to present evidence in support of what we call third party culpability, meaning evidence that supports the belief that someone other than Cal Harris was responsible, and that motion got denied. But But after the mistrial, and they decided to go to a fourth trial, Bruce, you know, got together with the defense team, and he said, you know, we're getting a new judge. I want to renew my third-party culpability argument, but I need something more. So we did a couple of things. One of them, we decided to excavate the burn pit on Stacy Stewart's property, because some witnesses had told us that there'd been a burning of bloody clothes there. So we arranged to do that with an archaeological a group from a college in Pennsylvania. They came up, they dug up the burn pit, they recovered some items, every item that was found was at least circumstantially linked to Michelle Harris. We couldn't positively say it was her, because there was no DNA found. It had just been too long a time of the evidence exposed to the heat and to the elements. But circumstantially, the evidence was pretty strong. So we made those arguments before the fourth trial, and the judge finally said that he would allow the presentation of third-party culpability to a limited extent. So that was a pretty good favorable decision. And as a result, we were able to bring in witnesses who described the burning of bloody clothes up at Stewart's property, and then a couple of students from the archaeological dig who described the items that were found. So we felt that was an important thing for the judge to know. And just so the readers know, the fourth trial was actually Cal decided to waive a jury and go with a bench trial, which is a pretty risky decision.
Sure.
But under the circumstances, we felt it was the right one, because we really didn't think we could expect a different result with a jury other than a mistrial. So as it turned out, that was a real good decision, and we had a real good judge presiding, so that made all the difference. You had mentioned the tearing up the concrete floor. We had actually developed information from a couple of witnesses that when Stacy bought his little cabin in the woods, that he had a barn there, or like a outbuilding where he kept his ATVs that he rode. And all indications were he had poured the concrete in the floor of the garage after Michelle went missing, but we couldn't confirm that. We tried. We reached out to concrete dealers and contractors, but you know, several years had passed, and their record keeping wasn't the greatest. So we were never able to confirm when the concrete was poured. But we were still interested in whether or not he might have used the concrete to help hide the body. So before we started digging, we brought in a ground penetrating radar and had them scan the garage floor. And it was not a real definitive, scan, but there was some type of mass large enough to be a human body, underneath the concrete. So we decided to go ahead and tear up the concrete, which we did ourselves, jackhammers and whatever it took, front end loaders, and we examined every piece of concrete we pulled out of there. And then once the concrete was out, we dug down 6 feet more. And we were really optimistic at one point that we might find her, but we never did. We were disappointed, but we kept looking, and we ended up digging up an old well. What else did we do out there? We had a diver search the pond. So we were doing as much as this on Stacy Stewart's property as the state police were doing on Cal's. But we were coming up empty also. One of the things that I should note about the items in the burn pit, when we asked to use those items as evidence in the trial, they were denied, even though they were circumstantially linked to Michelle. But Bruce made the argument, and I totally agree, that, had those same items been found in a burn pit on Cal's property, there was no doubt that they would have been used against him.
Yeah, yes. It's very fascinating, too, for people that are going to take the time to read this, that the Kevin Tubbs really changed this case in this trial and Cal Harris's future, but also that once he was on the stand and the attack on his credibility and his character, and then his responses, because he said, "I'm not going to take it." He had experience with the state police and said he was not going to take it, and so he certainly didn't. And it's fascinating for you to have this as part of the book, his defiant testimony and his success in being able to change the course of this case completely.
Yeah, Kevin, in my opinion, he's kind of the hero here. He didn't have to come forward. He told me more than once. He said, "I'm just trying to do the right thing."
Yeah,
and they attacked his credibility, and then. And one of the other disappointing thing for me was, when I developed all of this information about Stacy Stewart and Chris Thomason, I actually went to the state police and had a meeting with them and tried to convince them to pick up where I left off and to pursue Stacy Stewart and Chris Thomason to the next level, with their authority and their resources, they could have, in my opinion, I think the case could have been solved, but they chose not to do that. And that still disturbs me, that because I know how aggressive they can be when they pursue a suspect, and when it came to Stacy Stewart, they just didn't want to go there.
Mm-hmm. You don't paint a good picture of the conduct of many of the players in this, including Sil Mulvey and the state police itself, once they had their target set and what their sights set on their on who they wanted to prosecute. And you cite all of this in your book. Before we wrap up, what do you think really happened? As you write in the book, what are your conclusions on what happened and why?
I don't have a positive conclusion, but I have a reasonable hypothesis based on what my own investigation, what I learned from witnesses that we talked to after Kevin Tubbs came forward and I started looking at Stacy Stewart more closely. I believe that there was that when Michelle left Brian Early's house that night, she didn't go home. She went back and met up with Stacy Stewart at the nightclub. They danced and drank, got drunk together, and then the party continued up at his house. And I think Stacy had a couple of friends there, Chris Thomason and Wright Childers. And she may have thought there was safety in numbers, but they had other things in mind. And I think they may very well have been sexually assaulted. And then when she tried to go home, Stacy knew that would be trouble for him if she said anything. So he follows her and stops her at the end of the driveway. He's arguing with her, demanding that she get in the car. She's begging with him. Then along comes Kevin Tubbs. He sees what he sees, and then John Steele comes by and hears Stacy saying, "Get in the car, get in the damn car." And then after he's out of sight, Michelle's abducted by Stacy. And when she realizes that her chances of survival are not good if he gets her back to his cabin, she decides to save herself But unfortunately, even though she probably fought very heroically, he overpowered her and stabbed her right there in the truck. Just real quickly, we also caught up to and found Stacy's old truck down in Louisiana and had it examined.
Right, right.
Unfortunately, it's now been 14 years later, but there was still traces of blood on the back seat and behind the door panels on the passenger side that tested positive for blood, but only a partial DNA profile could be established. So we couldn't conclusively say that it was Michelle's blood. But interestingly, we also found a diamond-studded earring wedged in the seatbelt retractor on the passenger side that looked an awful lot like one of the earrings Michelle would wear when you look at some of her photographs. And it was all pitted and tarnished, but it was still intact. And there was a DNA profile on there that was inconclusive, but the one that was there could not eliminate Michelle.
Just an amazing story, and we just touched on it tonight, certainly.
Yeah, just touched on it. So I would encourage anybody who wants to learn more to read the book, and you'll learn everything.
Yes, absolutely. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Reign of Injustice, the Cal Harris story, David M. Beers. Is there a website, Facebook page, or just an Amazon page for them to take a look at this and this book?
Probably the best way right now, I think eventually I'm going to put together a web page, but I haven't done that yet. I do have an email that I set up just for the book. It's davidmbeers.author@gmail.com. And you can learn quite a bit by just going to Google on Amazon or whatever and just type in the title Reign of Injustice and everything will come up.
Yes. I want to thank you very much, David M. Beers, for coming on and talking about Reign of Injustice, the Cal Harris story. It is a fantastic investigation. I applaud you for your incredible, exhaustive investigation and this extraordinary book and chronicling this amazing case. I want to thank you very much, David M. Beers.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dan.
Thank you. Good night.
Thanks. Good night.